Joining us now from the Toronto Star, our friend Bruce Arthur. And Bruce, why don't we begin there with the National Football League? We are down to four. This, you know, when you look at it on that, the 49ers Eagles thing, I was reading somewhere somebody opining that this lacked the sizzle, but I don't know. I know it doesn't have Joe Burrow because he's engaged with Cincinnati taking on the Chiefs, but there's a lot to like in that 49ers Eagles matchup. Intriguing stuff.
Well, and I think the way Dallas played defensively against the 49ers, that's probably what's dampening this, because I remember we talked early in the season, and we talked about a bunch of 2-2 teams or 4-4 teams, and even then you could see that the 49ers had real strengths. This is long before Brock Purdy. This is long before Christian McCaffrey. But there are real strengths on that team, but Dallas has a real defense. Now, the Eagles are probably the class of the conference. They may even be the class of football, but of all the teams in the NFC, they can give them a run. I think Kyle Shanahan can game plan for the Eagles. I think the way that the 49ers managed to find and unlock new offensive concepts could really be helpful. And whether they can get to Jalen Hurts is going to be, again, the big question. Can you rush with four? Can you get almost four? To me, it's almost always the biggest question of any football game. And I think that the 49ers have a chance to do that. I don't think the Eagles are going to do to the 49ers what they did to the Giants. Like, that was not a football game. That was an execution. But in terms of this game, it's possible the Eagles are better, but I think the 49ers have a real shot.
I want to take you to Vancouver, and I don't know what to call it, a catastrophe. It certainly was a soap opera, but the moves around, Bruce Boudreau being fired, and the length of time, it was like a bloodletting gone mad. What are your thoughts now that it's over about how that was handled? And I don't know who to blame. Maybe that's the question.
Well, I mean, it's hard. Like, we've seen a million coach firings, right? We've seen firings where the coach knows it's coming. We've seen firings where the fans know it's coming. We've seen Toronto firings before. This was different, and it's hard to understand what the Canucks were thinking. Because Jim Rutherford comes out afterwards and says, you know, it's the fault. The problem was the speculation here. Well, why was speculation, Jim? Why on earth could that be? Was it because you were like everyone knew this was going to happen for a year, and partly because the front office had basically made it clear that that was the case? The organizing, like, you don't have to listen to the fans. If you listen to the fans in the Canadian market, you will wind up sitting with them. It's one of those truisms that is absolutely true. But the disconnect between the Canucks and the market in terms of how they handled this, if you fire Bruce Boudreau in an honest, normal way, if you do it in a way that doesn't wind up with one of the most beloved people in hockey standing on the bench in tears because he doesn't know if his career's over, with the fans cheering for the coach that you're about to fire and they know it, like, tell me what that says about the relationship between the organization and the people cheering for it. These guys are totally disconnected from the market. And if you're going to do that, that's fine. If you want to be totally disconnected from the market you're working in, that's fine. You better be running a hell of an organization, and that's where the Canucks are in real trouble, because they're not.
Well, Bruce, that takes me rather smoothly into my next question, which was the Harold Ballard documentary. A very young me, many years ago, walked down a back stairwell at the Pacific Coliseum in the company of Harold Ballard, and I think I asked him one question about Michel Petit, who was a young defenseman for the Leafs, and he growled something in my direction. But, man, I had forgotten a lot of Ballard stuff, and this brought it all back, and not much of it was good.
It was impossibly bad.
Yes.
Like, it was impossibly bad. It was, if you made it into a movie, you'd be like, this is over the top. They're going to need to tone him down 25%. I put one of these examples in the column last week, talking about a firing. The year he fired Roger Nielsen, except that Harold Ballard was afraid to actually confront Roger Nielsen, so he tells people that Roger Nielsen is fired. Roger Nielsen is on the plane home from a loss and gets told that he's been fired, but Harold hasn't told him he's been fired, so he shows up at practice the next day, and he's looking for Harold, and Harold is nowhere to be found. And finally, Roger has to kind of admit that he has been fired, so he packs up his stuff and leaves. The players howl about this. The media howls about this. The fans howl about this. Because they don't think Roger should have been fired, certainly not this way. And so Harold Ballard, because he's at his heart an idiot coward, he says, well, we're just going to bring Roger back. But his condition to bring Roger back is to turn it into a show, that Roger would wear a paper bag out onto the bench and then take it off, revealing that he had not, in fact, been fired. And Roger was going to do it until he got talked out of it, and eventually he walked onto the bench. But for a while, Harold was saying, that's a condition. This son of a dog has got to wear the paper bag. Think about that. This guy owns the biggest, richest, fanciest club in the country outside of the much more regal and dignified Montreal Canadiens. It's impossible how bad Harold Ballard was.
One of my favorite moments in all history, all recorded history, was Roger Neilson's acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame, where he said, I'll see you soon down there, Harold, or something like that, which I thought was appropriate based on their relationship.
Well, and he was a bad guy, right? Like, yeah. It wasn't just comical. It was actually actively bad. Like, the Usher abuse stuff at Maple Leaf Gardens is really horrific. Yeah. Like, the way he treated people was terrible. When people talk about how the Leafs haven't won since 67, it really is incredible. Because remember, 67 is the last time they win. 68 is the year that the league expands beyond six teams. The Leafs have not made a Stanley Cup final since there were more than six teams in the NHL. That's amazing. But a huge chunk of that is Harold Ballard. Like, he owns the team into the 90s, right? Like, he owns the team for a really long time, and Harold just wouldn't die. And that you could not have won with an owner like that. It would have been impossible. And that's something we still see to a far lesser degree, I think, in sports now. But when we point to Vancouver, the people who really cover that team day-to-day say, you know, Jim Rutherford, he's made mistakes here, but he hasn't lost his mind, I don't think. The problem you get is the direction of ownership, the culture that is created by ownership. Francisco Iacolini is not a great owner, and that's why the Canucks are where they are, and that's why Bruce Boudreau happened the way he did.
Bruce Arthur with us here on Low Tide and Jameson on TSN 1260. Just back to football for a moment. Tom Brady, I don't know if you heard the clip. He was on with Jim Gray. I mean, you talk about friendly fire. They've done a show together. This was on a podcast, but he reacted really strongly, Brady, that is, to a question which Jim Gray should ask and did ask, which is, hey, what are you doing about that career of yours? Like, what have you made it? You know, just a simple question that anyone would want to know the answer to. And he reacted in a way that I thought was either, I don't know if it was orchestrated or what, but it was not what I was expecting.
You always have to leave open the door. You're right, Al, that it could be orchestrated, because Tom Brady likes to do creative kind of reality show stuff involving his career. He likes to be in charge of that. But this felt weird. Like what he said, like, you know, if I knew what I was going to bleep and do, I would already bleep and done it. Taking a day of rest. Like, that to me tells, let's assume it's real, then it's kind of sad, right? Like, I know that Tom Brady's probably sick of being asked this, but he's the one who's done the dance for year after year after year. He's actually retired already once and then unretired. So once you get into that territory, you're just going to get asked a lot, and you have to know that Jim Gray is going to ask you if you've been on the show with him forever. But I think that this has to, unless he's a total robot, this last year has to have taken a real toll on Tom Brady. I mean, his marriage broke up, right? Like, that's not a small thing. And it broke up because he kept playing football, and he kept playing football for a terrible team that had an embarrassing playoff loss. I mean, it's got to be difficult, because this is a guy who's had one of the most glory-drenched careers, and pretty much the best career anyone's ever had. And so it can't be easy that he's in this position. And he still doesn't seem to want to know he wants to walk away. So I just wonder what ending Tom Brady's looking for, man. I just wonder what will be enough. And my guess is that he might be one of those guys who pushes it until he can't push it anymore, until a defensive lineman, like, bears down from the blind side, and that one time Tom doesn't see it. Because I'm not sure what's going to get him to walk away.
Well, there's always George Blanda. He can kick for 12 more years. They could do that. Here's a story that we don't spend enough time on, and we should. Brooke Henderson is like 25, and the LPGA has their Hall of Fame requirements. It's a 27-point system to get there. She's, I think, at 17 now. She's had all kinds of things occur to her that should make it difficult for her to win, and all she does is win. Greatest Canadian golfer ever by far, and she's, you know, 25.
Yeah, and because she's already had her first win, and she's won like majors, and so that becomes kind of a thing where you just assume she's good, but she's starting to accumulate now. And that's where it gets really, really interesting. I believe she's now number one on the LPGA Tour standings, right? Like, that is really, it's significant. Like, she is maybe the best women's golfer of her generation, period. And we can't say that about a lot of sports in Canada, outside of hockey, obviously. We always produce the best hockey player, more or less. But it's rarer for Canada to produce the best athlete in the world in any given sport. Like, Olympics is one thing, but like professional sports where there's a grind, where there's this much of a global competition, it's hard to do. And so Brooke Henderson, we should pay a little more attention, you're right, because there's something really special there.
Bruce, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at any of the Breakpoint, which is the tennis tour's equivalent of Drive to Survive, which did amazing things for F1, really grew the sport, built a brand new audience in many cases. I watched all five episodes, and I'm struck by a few things, but I'm watching it going, I don't know if this is going to convert people to going from either not liking the sport or having very little interest to becoming avid fans. I know we chase stuff in entertainment and sports. I just don't know if, you know, you can replicate what F1 did.
Well, and I haven't seen it yet. I'd like to see it. I'm going to get around to it. But, like, that is the trick, is that what F1 did with Drive to Survive is they really did pull you not all the way behind the curtain, but enough. And there was enough in the sport. It was produced in the quality of the production. Like, it was a really well-made television show with interesting kind of weirdos at the heart of it. And it really was the guys who run the teams were more interesting than the drivers, I thought.
Yeah.
With tennis, that dynamic isn't quite there in the same way. And the problem you get with tennis is there's lots of interesting aspects to the sport. I love the sport. I think it's some of the greatest drama there is. It is also kind of built to drill the personality out of the people who play it. So you have to choose the people you're going to feature very carefully, because in F1, it's a pretty limited field, right? Like, you've only got 20 drivers. In tennis, it's a much wider, like, you have more choices of people to feature. And so you have to choose that well. You have to have really quality trust, and you need to have really good production values. It'll be hard to do it as well as F1 did, because that is, at this point, the bar.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Bruce. We'll talk next week.
Dave, Al, always my pleasure, guys.
All right. Bruce Arthur there from the Toronto Star.